Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. On this evening's program, the Alberta Research Council presents its annual review, this time in Calgary, to highlight the growing importance of that city as a research center. And paleontologist Jonathan Perry demonstrates his chewing machine, a little device that's leading to surprising new insights into the diet of early primates. And internationally acclaimed ichthyologist Dr. Joe Nelson talks about his latest work on fishes of the world. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Earlier today, hundreds of researchers and industry players gathered in Calgary to hear the year-end review of the Alberta Research Council. The council has come a long way since 1921, when Dr. Carl Clark worked on separating oil sands in the basement of the University of Alberta's power plant. Today, the ARC is very near its goal of becoming a $100 million a year corporation. Over the last year, commercialization of technology has created 800 new jobs while generating $167 million in new sales for its clients. Karen Beliveau is the Director of Technology Commercialization for the Alberta Research Council, and she credits the Council's recent success to the leadership of its new CEO.
3 years ago, in 1997, when John McDougall first joined the Research Council, he set out a new vision and mandate for the Council, and said at that time that he would like to see the organization grow to be a $100 million corporation by the year 2005. And I can tell you, for many of us that had been around, that was a very ambitious goal. And today we're well down the road of meeting that goal. This past year, we achieved $78 million in annual revenues, which is a 10% increase over the past year, which is very impressive. And we also achieved $3.6 million in annual royalties and revenues from the commercialization of our technology. That's double what we did the previous year, and it also shows a 14-fold increase over the last 5 years. I think that if you take a look at how the council has evolved over the last 80 years, our original mandate continues to remain very much the same. It was linking the importance of science and technology to the economic development of our province. And today, that's still very much at the core of this organization. And my job in particular, and an area that is growing considerably, is the whole area of commercializing technology, making sure that what we're doing in the labs and on behalf of industry gets out into the marketplace, into new products and processes where they really can make a difference to the economic prosperity of our province. And on that side, we do measure our performance on an annual basis. We undertake a customer survey that speaks to the number of jobs and the impact of the work that the Alberta Research Council has on the companies that we work with and the ultimate economy of Alberta.
Your annual review is being presented in Calgary this time around. Why is that?
Well, in 1999, we did open up a new facility in Calgary to give us more of a presence in that city. And I think that what we want to be able to do is go back and report on how well we're doing. And Calgary is a very, very important part of the technology community in Alberta. And we want to be able to strengthen our relationships with that community and continue to grow them. We also have a very strong relationship with the University of Calgary, and many of the small companies that are housed adjacent to the Alberta Research Council in the new research park there as part of Calgary Technologies, Inc. And so I think that we just want to be able to come back and report on how well we're doing and to let people know what we're doing so that we can be more connected to the technology community within the city of Calgary.
What do you see as being some of the key areas that you'd be focusing on
in Calgary as far as technology and technology commercialization?
Okay. Well, there are a number of areas. I think I'll highlight a couple here. Our health informatics group is very involved in developing new information systems for the management of chronic diseases. And in that area, we've teamed up with the Calgary Regional Health Authority, along with a local technology company here in the city of Edmonton called Rome IT. So that's one example. We're also working in the fuel cell area, which is a very exciting and dynamic technology area right now. And we've teamed up with a company by the name of Energy Ventures, Inc., out of Ontario, who's relocating their fuel cell division to Calgary. And we are undertaking the development of a proof of concept direct methanol fuel cell for that company. So that's being carried out in our Calgary facility. We are also doing an awful lot of work in the geomatics area, where we've teamed up with the University of Calgary. And there are many small companies that we've worked with. This past year, we just completed a joint venture with a company in Calgary by the name of Ceramic Protection Corporation. And we worked with them in improving their ceramic ballistic armor that are used in armored vehicles for the police and military service. And this company was recently acknowledged by the American Ceramic Society for a technical merit achievement. And it's the first Canadian company in the 100-year history of this organization to be recognized. So we're very pleased to have been part of that work, and we're certainly pleased to see ceramic protection being recognized in that way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Karen Béliveau, Director of Technology Commercialization for the Alberta Research Council. Coming up, mastication in the extreme. Can you guess what this sound is? It's not a washing machine, and it's not a pump. No, this is the clever invention of a young paleontologist at the University of Alberta. When Jonathan Perry set out to research his master's thesis on the diet of early primates, he figured he'd get some clues from their teeth and how they functioned. But how do you do that when your research subjects are already extinct?
Well, it's known as the chewing machine or the mastication machine, and it essentially simulates chewing in early fossil primates using as a model a primitive species of small African primate.
Did you develop and build this yourself?
Yes, I did.
Where did you get the idea?
Well, through discussions with my supervisor and then looking through the literature on simulating mastication in general, I came across a paper from the mid-60s where a professor from St. Louis simulated mastication in humans, essentially to try and reproduce patterns of wear in modern Aboriginal populations. And the design of that machine sort of inspired the design for this one. So,
what is it that you're trying to find out?
Well, I'm trying to find out something about the relationship between the physical shapes of teeth, especially the premolars and molars in primates, and what kinds of food that they break down. And this I'm sort of using as an estimate for diet in fossil primates, for which we can't know the actual diet for certain.
Well, if some of these species that you're dealing with are extinct, how would you test it out?
Well, what I've done is I've used a modern analog as the basis for all the muscle parameters, so muscle forces and the orientation of pull of the various different muscles. And I've constructed it such that at its focus is the cast of a skull of one of these modern primates. And I've made it so that it's possible to insert different dentitions into this skull, essentially as dentures, and glue them down to the skull. And then I can test how different species perform on different types of food. And this gives me some idea of relative effectiveness of food breakdown.
So what would be some of the species that you're putting in there, trying out?
Things that might be familiar to you as lemurs or lorises. This machine in particular is based on something called a bush baby, which is a small African nocturnal primitive primate. And as for the fossil primates that I'm testing, they're mostly from the Paleocene, so the epoch just following the death of the dinosaurs, and the succeeding epoch, the Eocene, so about 50 million years old. A group of archaic primates called the plesiodapiforms lived in the Paleocene, and it's questionable whether or not they're primates, and I've tested a number of species of those, and also the very first true primates, so the first primates that would have all of the necessary characteristics to include them in the order primates. So some of the species that I've tested are likely to have been our ancestors.
Well, let's fire it up and see how it works.
All right.
This looks like something right out of one of these 1930s or 1940 movies.
Yeah,
you've got a bunch of screws and a bicycle chain going around and a little motor, and then this this little skull down here is just chewing away very badly.
Yeah. Well, it's essentially powered by a motor, as you can see, a fairly small motor. And the motor turns a couple camshafts, just like you'd have in your car, more or less. But, of course, much smaller. And the cams, as they turn, impact upon rocking wooden arms, which then lift a cable. And each cable simulates a different muscle of mastication.
Well, I would think that if you don't get anywhere with your master's thesis, you could certainly find another career as a mechanic.
That's right.
So, in working with all of this, what have you found out so far?
Well, I found out some interesting patterns. In order to make certain that the machine is doing what it's supposed to, I've used, as I said, living species of primates. And the virtue of them is that they have known diets from ecological field studies. And turns out that those species that I tested, for which diet is known, are in fact breaking down food effectively that they're eating in the wild. So the foods that they eat preferentially are also the foods that they break down preferentially in this machine. So that confirms, I guess, the usefulness of the machine. There's one interesting species of living primate, a loris from Asia, for which very little was known about its diet. And I tested it and found that it eats mostly insects, but also a lot of fruit and leaves and things like that. And since I've tested it, I've actually learned from a colleague that very recently they've discovered that this primate eats those things in the wild, something that wasn't known before.
Well, how could you even tell that from it? What sorts of things would you be putting in there for them to chew up?
Well, a lot of things that you'd find in a grocery store. Nuts, fruits, leaves, flower petals, insects, like crickets and mealworms that you'd get at a pet store.
I'm glad you said pet store, because I don't buy those at the grocery store.
Right, yeah. So a wide variety of foods. And what I've done is, for each different food type, I've broken it down in the machine through 10 chewing cycles with 5 samples for each type of food, for each species that I'm testing. And then after the food's chewed up, I collect all the fragments that result from the chewing. And what I've done is I've passed them through a column of sieves to sort out various size brackets. And assuming that more smaller fragments indicates a better bout of chewing, then those foods that end up with more smaller fragments are those which are better chewed. And I've inferred that this may indicate something about the diet of the animal in question. And actually, I've learned some interesting things about the diets of fossil primates as well. The archaic primates that I mentioned earlier, the plesiodapiforms, were originally thought to have been eating mostly insects. But the ones that I've tested here are actually turning out to have more herbivorous tendencies. They're breaking down leaves very well, fruits very well, and nuts very well. And they're not breaking down insects very well at all. Whereas when you get into the first true primates, these Eocene ancestors of ours, it looks like they're starting to specialize more and more in terms of their diet. Some species do very well with fruits, whereas others do very well with insects. So we're seeing a greater polarization in the diet there.
Well, what would be the difference in the teeth that would make it easier to chew up insects on one hand or other things on the other hand?
Well, it looks like those species that are breaking down insects very well are species with particularly sharp tooth cusps. So cusps that have a very small volume for their height tend to be breaking down insects very well. And those with very blunt cusps are better at breaking down fruit, for example. And you can imagine that there would be intermediate conditions of tooth shape for different types of food.
When you look at the overall significance of the work that you've done, what would you say it is?
Well, just looking at the machine itself, it provides a novel method for testing hypotheses about food breakdown and diet. And it's a method that could be applied to a number of different kinds of animals, not just these early primates, but other types of mammals and perhaps even beyond mammals, things like dinosaurs or whatever. And this type of machine is relatively simple to make with fairly rudimentary technology, so it can be reproduced by others and tested on other types of animals. And it simply provides us with a new method to test these extinct animals for which you can't just go out and observe diet.
Is there a patent pending on this?
Possibly. Possibly.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Okay, thank you very much as well.
Jonathan Perry is a graduate student in paleontology at the University of Alberta. And with the help of his chewing machine, he successfully defended his thesis this spring. Coming up, fishes of the world. When Joe Nelson was a kid growing up in a BC mining town, his heart was set on becoming an astronomer. But those hopes were dashed when a high school math teacher told him he needed to be a math genius in order to make it as an astronomer. That's when Joe turned his sights downward, down into the watery depths of the world's rivers, lakes, and oceans. Today, Dr. Joe Nelson is a genius of another kind. He's an ichthyologist, a man who studies fish. A professor in biological sciences at the University of Alberta, Joe astounded his peers by writing what's become the Ichthyologist's Bible. It's called Fishes of the World. I spoke with Dr. Nelson as he worked on the fourth edition of this ambitious book.
It's been a mammoth task I first got involved in when I realized in teaching ichthyology that there was nothing comprehensive, nothing that synthesized the available information on phylogenetic relationships. And these are important for students to learn when they're graduating in the subject, the area of ichthyology, and it's important in researchers, regardless of what they're researching about fish. As long as they're doing comparative work, they must know the latest in systematic relationships. So I thought I would synthesize the literature, put it together with my own research, and publish it, which I was lucky to do in 1976. So it's been a long time back, and I'm still going with it.
Now, 1976, the first edition, that's when that came out, and you're now working on the fourth edition. How have things changed over those 30 years?
Well, there have been so much exciting work in fish systematics. People are finding all sorts of new things about evolutionary relationships, and the field is rapidly changing. So I've had a lot to do to keep up with it because there are a lot of fish. There's about 24,000 species in a lot of different families, so hundreds of researchers working on them, and it's a very exciting time as we're learning more about their genealogical relationships. So I'm trying to put this together in a form for users all around the world.
How would you take something that's so vast, you say 24,000 species, how do you take that and divide it up in such a way that you can actually deal with it in a volume?
Well, I do it by families. So there's about 450 families of fishes, and so the book is organized that way. And so what I'm really doing is looking at the relationships of the families and not the species per se.
Can you give me some examples about how things have advanced, something that's of particular interest to you?
Right. Well, I think one of the big changes that I've seen since 1976, and there are a lot of them, it's an endless series of examples. I can pick two examples. One is the hagfish, the relationships of hagfishes to the other species of fish. And hagfishes, that might sound like an awful name, but it's a very slimy fish that's a marine fish. And we used to think its closest relative was the lamprey. And that's a fish we have in Alberta. The lamprey is in the Slave River. It's a small parasitic fish, normally. And we used to think, as I say, the lamprey and the hagfish were each other's closest relatives. Now we know that lampreys are, as hard as it is to believe, more closely related to us humans than it is to the hagfish. So that has resulted in a vast rethinking of our... anything we did with hagfish has had to be rethought in terms of its place in evolutionary relationships.
What accounts for this change in being able to research and understand the differences?
Well, it's new methodology. We've come a long way over the last decades. We have a new approach to doing systematics. We also have many, many more people looking at more characters, including molecular characters, so we know a lot more about the fish. And when I talk about a new methodology, I'm talking about now a genealogical methodology, where we're not just looking at fish that might look similar and saying, oh, well, the lamprey and the hagfish look similar. They're both naked, eel-like. They lack paired appendages. Therefore, they must be closely related. We're taking a genealogical approach and asking a very specific question, the question being, what is the closest relative to this particular lineage? Where do they share a common branching point? And we're defining relationships on those terms. And that's caused a complete rethinking of everything we know about, animal and plant evolution. We can talk about birds, crocodiles, and dinosaurs. And we've had a rethinking there. In other words, if we ask the question, what are the closest relatives of dinosaurs? What are the closest living relatives of dinosaurs? We now would say it's birds, not snakes, lizards, turtles, etc. So that's the methodology I'm talking about.
You're also involved in another international project, and that's the naming of fishes. How did you get involved in that?
Well, I was appointed chair of this committee in 1992. It is a committee comprising two societies, the American Fisheries Society and the American Society of Ichthyologists and Herpetologists. The term American here is in the broad context. These are North American societies, and this particular committee that I chair comprises two Canadians, three Americans, and two Mexicans. So we have truly an international mixture here, and our mandate is to produce or revise a list of all of the fishes that occur in North America, whether they be freshwater or saltwater. So it gives an accurate documentation as to what we have, and more importantly, it gives what common name we should be using. Take the walleye here in the province. We know that throughout North America there were 80 different common names for this one species of fish. And some of those common names were used in other parts of North America for other species. So you can see the problem.
Well, I can certainly see the change between pickerel and walleye, because I grew up going to the pickerel hole with my dad to go fishing, and now, of course, it's the walleye. But some of these name changes actually are quite political, aren't they? I'm thinking of the squawfish.
Yes. Our basic principle in this list is to have standardized common names to keep the names stable That's in contrast to scientific names, which are forever changing as we, well, to reflect evolutionary relationships. But we strongly feel common names should remain stable. That way people get used to a name and they take it on into their vocabulary and are comfortable with it. So a rainbow trout will forever be a rainbow trout. Now, we do have one principle that can override that. That is, the common names must be in good taste. They must not be, and I don't mean taste in the sense of taste of the fish, but that just dawned on me what I was saying. But the name mustn't be offensive to any group. And we've had, there are all sorts of names which you can theorize about being potentially offensive, but most of them are quite frivolous. But we've had two cases of names where we've had petitions and people meeting with us to say these names to us are offensive. And yes, the first one was the squawfish, and we met with some tribal councils in Seattle, Washington in 1997, and the following year changed the name squawfish to pike minnow. This is a fish that's here in Alberta, by the way, in the Peace River, but it's very common. Anyone who fishes in British Columbia will know of squawfish. They eat, and what we now call pike minnow, they eat little salmon, and that's why many people don't like them. But lots of things eat small salmon, so there's nothing bad about the fish. There's no bad fish. So the pike minnow is one fish that we've had this name change. The jewfish is the most recent example, and where we've changed its name to Goliath grouper. Goliath as a common noun for its large size, as we talk about a Goliath meeting, a Goliath beetle, etc.
The work that you've been doing with the committee, then, when will the new revised list be coming out?
We hope, Cheryl, that it will be available January of 2002. So right now I'm busy on my computer wrapping up the final touches for a committee meeting in about 2 weeks' time, where we'll go over some remaining problems. Then I hope it's submitted for publication this early fall. So it should be out just after Christmas, I'm afraid. Yeah.
And Fishes of the World, when can we expect to see the fourth edition?
Well, that will be more likely in 2 years' time. There's a lot of work left to go on that one.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Cheryl. Glad to do it.
That was Dr. Joe Nelson, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Along with Dr. Martin Pates, he also wrote Fishes of Alberta, which is available in bookstores across the province. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.